this time while I'm talking, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to gift to WBAI.org online. That's once again 212-209-2950 or go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. You've heard throughout the month about our financial situation where we are behind the rent. We used to be up to 10 months behind the rent. I think we're now have gotten it down to at least 5 months, maybe even 4 months, but we're still behind and we still need your help. And while this special programming is happening, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station. How many people know about the NACBA outside of regular listeners here at WBAI New York? Few and far between. I know me personally, and I have said this many of times, that I knew everything about what is happening in Palestine to the Palestinian people because of WBAI. And I was well-versed and well-aware of what has been happening there since the 1990s for me personally. And that's only happening because there were people that were here that was delivering the information and making the connections of marginalized people throughout the world. Like, for instance, how is it the conditions of the Palestinians any different from the conditions with indigenous people here in this part of the world? For African Americans in this part of the world? For Latinos in this part of the world? It's all connected. I think the thing is that we need to understand, because of one thing that is happening in another part of the world, don't make you think that it's not connected to you, it's not affecting to you. This is what we do here at WBAI. So please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950. Now, I can go on for hours about this, but we're about to go into the next program focusing on Radio Free Palestine here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Coming up next will be Building Bridges, I think, with Mimi Rosenberg, of course. So stay tuned.
Program is part of a Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across 5 continents. Tasha's Equal Rights and Justice. Well, I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is Equal Rights and Justice. Now, we're joined by a clapping, vibing Anne Wright. And Anne Wright is one of the 3 State Department officials to publicly resign in direct protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Anne was also a passenger on the Challenger 1, an aid flotilla that sought to break the blockade of Gaza when Israel murdered 10 of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. She's just returned from Turkey, where another humanitarian aid flotilla seeks to break the blockade on Gaza, but remains stalled, unable to set sail under the flag of Guinea-Bissau. And we are most honored to have Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer as she tried to prevent the destruction of a Palestinian home in Rafah. Then there's Chip Givens, Policy and Legislative Council for Defending Rights and Dissent, a national advocacy organization dedicated to defending civil liberty. Well, I am, again, truly honored to have all of you with us. Cindy and Craig, the energy, the righteousness, the humanity of young Rachel Corey, who went to Gaza, who was in Rafah to try and stop the demolitions of homes of the Palestinians in the unrelenting effort of Zionist Israel to continue to Judaicize all of historic Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. I am most interested in your thoughts, the legacy of Rachel in this particular time. It's the worst of times and yet the best of times, because perhaps now the world is awakening to the plight of the Palestinians and ready to stand up for this indigenous people of the historic landmass of Palestine. And so much thank you for joining us. Cindy, Craig, your thoughts.
Comparing the horrible thing that happened to Rachel with the possibility of something beautiful. What now we know about the driver of that bulldozer, that it's a little harder for me to imagine, but we should be keeping those ideas alive, that we can do so much better. And as we meet the other, that can be a real blessing for us, and it can be a joy. And instead, we're looking at this genocide and seeing the other as an enemy rather than somebody to join life with.
Forward. And I have to admit, when Rachel was killed, we didn't know what to expect. We were very new to all of this. She had brought us, we'd lived with the issue, of course, for our lifetimes. But Rachel brought us to the, as a family, to the issue while she was in Gaza and before. Thinking about her legacy, we're very humbled, and she would be incredibly humbled and probably think it wasn't deserved, a lot of the attention that she's gotten. I know she'd think that. But I do think that her story brought people to this issue and continues to. Now there are generations that haven't heard the story. Even out at the Evergreen State College where she attended and where there's a memorial, we're seeing all this learning happening. Young people who come to us and don't know that there's a memorial on their campus to Rachel, you know. So I guess the fact that she's helped to bring people to Gaza, to help to make those connections, to help people understand through 21 years. And with more attention now, of course, and with more people really paying attention, I think. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, we'll continue to find out more, because there really is a legacy, and there's a lot of activity that was going on recently on the campus, which should give heart to all of us. Although we'll find out the counterpoint to that, which is with the rise in dissent comes the rise by the empire in trying to repress. But I can't help but think for a moment that Anne Wright experienced the death of 10 people on an aid flotilla that she was
part of that was long before October 7th, trying to break the blockade in what has been described as the largest open-air prison in the world, and that was Gaza. Your thoughts and connectivity to the issue of the commitment of this young woman, Rachel Corey, and your experience there. And please, all of you, interchange your thoughts. You're all committed for decades now to the issue of a free, free Palestinian state, nation, and to equal rights and justice and humanitarianism. So, and begin to educate us on that experience with the flotilla. And then we've got some special questions for Chip, given the, as I said, even yesterday as we speak, the committees that came together to try and use the issue of anti-Semitism in the most manipulative way to, again, silence dissent. Anne Wright?
I ended up resigning from the government virtually the same month that Rachel was killed. I resigned in March of 2003, and she was killed in 2003. I'd put in my letter of resignation, I resigned over the Bush war on Iraq, a couple of other things besides the pending war on Iraq, and one of them was the unbalanced policies of the United States on Israel and Palestine. I really hadn't had any direct work as a diplomat or in the military on Israel and Palestine, but it was always one of the questions that would come up to you as a diplomat. Why does the U.S. always support Israel and never even really acknowledges the Palestinians? Well, it wasn't until 2009 with the Operation Cast Lead, 27 days, I believe it was, with an attack that killed 1,400 Palestinians. And that's when Dia Benjamin, Ty Berry, and I went to Gaza for the first time on a fast trip just to witness the huge level of destruction that had occurred there, minor in a way compared to what we now see. But then it was in 2009, we came back committed to bring more people to Gaza. And then Craig and Cindy were on one of the first trips that Code Pink took back on International Women's Day, and five more trips during 2009. And then the Gaza Freedom March at the end of 2009. And then during all that time, this group called the Free Gaza Movement was actually trying to take tiny little boats, little fishing boats from Cyprus into Gaza. Remarkably, they succeeded. There were, in 2008, there were six trips that they got through the Israeli blockade and landed in Gaza, much to the tumultuous welcome by people in Gaza. When you see the pictures of the thousands of people that came down to the Gaza docks and kids jumping in the water, swimming out to the boats and everything. The next year, Cast Lead happened, 2009, and then the Free Gaza Movement started organizing this big flotilla, which had seven ships in it, the Mavi Marmara, one of them, Challenger 1, which I was on. I was very fortunate. I did not have to endure the actual watching of the Israelis executing 10 people on the Mavi Marmara and wounding 50. But we were in the boat next to it, and our Australian journalist captured most of the iconic photos that we have of the Israeli attack on the Mavi Marmara. Since then, we've now sailed 35 boats to try to break the illegal Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. We haven't succeeded, but we have succeeded in continuing the international attention toward the fact that there is that blockade going around Gaza. And the flotilla concept itself, has helped educate, as Craig and Cindy said, the education of all of these tragic events that happened between the killing of Rachel and the killing of the people on the Mavi Marmara. All of these help people better understand how brutal and ruthless the Israeli government is, and primarily to Palestinians, but it does go on to internationals on some level. Right now, the Gaza flotilla, we have three ships that are in Turkey. I just have come back from Istanbul, having been there for 3 weeks as a part of the coordinating committee to try to get these ships on the move. As with virtually every one of the flotillas, we have been met with a variety of stops, and all instigated by the government of Israel and by the government of the United States. This one is the Israeli government put the heavy hand on the country of Guinea-Bissau that had flagged two of the three of the ships to jerk the flag at the last moment. The Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, we were called over to the Marvy Marmer Association, and they said, we've just received a notification that we no longer have a flag to sail under for two of our ships. The next day, the passengers were going to get on these boats. So we had 150 internationals that were in Istanbul and over 600 Turkish citizens that were ready to go out of 12,000 applicants from Turkey that want to be on the flotilla. Over 4 million Turkish citizens have contributed small amounts of money to buy boats to sail against the Israeli blockade. And then, of course, the international campaign that's contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars raised all over the world to get these boats. So right now we're in a holding pattern because we want to make sure we get flags on those ships that countries will not succumb to Israeli or U.S. pressure. And we're also challenged by, you know, the government of Turkey, which on one level has been very good about challenging the Israeli genocide. And in fact, Turkey just this last week said that it was cutting off all trade with Israel. But the fact that it does get pressure from the U.S. and other NATO partners about this little tiny thing called a flotilla. And don't let those little boats go. It really, you know, it puts too much of a strain on the armadas of military ships that are sitting out protecting Israel. You know, the U.S. has an aircraft carrier and associated probably 10 other U.S. military ships that are there, plus the military ships that are building this pier to nowhere, $320 million to build a pier that is one of the most Rubik's things I've ever seen in my life. Bottom line is we will sail. We've been delayed. It probably will be a delay of a month, but please stay tuned because we are going to challenge that Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I want to ask Chip, in response to the world is speaking out, boots on the ground, lawsuits, there's a condemnation of the brutality of Israel and a recognition more and more that settler colonialism, that is what the ideological state of Zionism is. It is that form of nationalism, and it has structured itself into an apartheid state. The world is speaking out in condemnation and saying, not in my name, colonialism equals genocide. There's ethnocide going on. Colleges are moving to divest at record speeds, which we've never seen before in this country, even during the apartheid movement, certainly not in this short time period since October 7th. So how are we doing with the First Amendment? How are we doing with the Bill of Rights? What should we understand about the accompaniment almost always relevant to defending the rights and the response of empire to dissent against its policy and practices, people to engage each other.
Lane, I don't remember when I heard of Rachel Corrie in Bush's second term, so shortly thereafter, and it was along very Maryland summer break in college, visiting my parents' Facebook about it. It was so shocking. I mean, the Israelis had rammed and they had to or expected 10 human amendment. It's been a long 2 decades on this issue, more and more people waking up, and the number of people who are conscious of Palestine is growing. I've adhered to the BDS call since back in 2007 when you were adhering to a boycott of Israel. You didn't always want to explain to some people what you were doing, and if you did, even lefty ones would look at you like you were insane. And Mimi, one of the reasons why I like your show so much is that you understand the relationship between the repression of dissent and the crimes of U.S. empire. Obviously, from a First Amendment standpoint, the government has to be viewpoint, content neutral, et cetera. And, you know, everyone has the same First Amendment rights, whether they support Israel or Palestine. But we see a crackdown against one side, and that side is the Palestinian side. And that is because the U.S. government is funding the genocide in Gaza. The U.S. government has been funding the apartheid state of Israel and their apartheid policies against the Palestinian people for many, many, many decades. And that is what is fueling the crisis right now. I've said repeatedly that since October the 7th, the United States has entered what is the worst crisis for civil liberties in several decades, at least since the early years of the war on terror. I really am getting George Bush vibes from the Joe Biden administration, which do with that what you will. And we see just this endless assault on the right to just speak out against not just our government, but a foreign government. I mean, every week or every month in the House, they have a new resolution, non-binding ones, condemning this person or that person. I swear they've done the same resolution to condemning the phrase "from the river to the sea" multiple times. At this point, I've just lost track. It's impossible to keep track of it. But on top of these really vile but ultimately non-binding resolutions, you see like actual binding legislation that's extremely disturbing passing out of the House of Representatives. We saw the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, and anti-Semitism is a deplorable and disgusting form of bigotry, and we should be aware of it, and we should oppose it, and we should root it out of our society. But the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act amends sort of how the Department of Education enforces civil rights on college campuses to force them to consider or define anti-Semitism based on what's now called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. This same definition has been around for a long time and has been called at different times. The State Department definition, the EU Working Group definition. I much preferred those names because it's very hard to criticize something called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition and the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. They know, much like with the Patriot Act, they know quite what they're doing in naming things. And what it does is it equates political speech critical of Israel, including anti-Zionist speech, with anti-Semitism. And it does that by saying we're going to adopt the definition or the examples that the definition uses, and then doesn't include those examples in the text of the bill, which is really very sneaky because people, you know, in theory, don't even know what they're voting on. So if this passes the Senate and if it passes the Department of Education when looking at claims of civil rights violations, including a hostile environment, would consider the idea that saying Israel is a racist endeavor and Israel is an apartheid state engaged in a genocide, that is a racist endeavor, okay? Or my favorite, holding Israel to a double standard, which I find sort of, you know, sickly amusing because Israel is given a double standard all the time. It is allowed to commit crimes no other state is allowed to commit because of the U.S. backing and the U.S. impunity. But that is apparently not what they mean by double standard. They are engaging in this fiction that by criticizing Israel for murdering 34,000 Palestinian people, over half of them children, for killing people as they flee their homes on the route that you tell them to flee, for killing aid workers. These anti-Palestinian pro-apartheid groups have filed frivolous legal challenges against college campuses, claiming that by having students who are engaged in political speech for Palestinian rights, it is creating an anti-Semitic hostile environment. And all of these claims have always been rejected by the Department of Education. And the hope is that by forcing them to use this definition, they'll have to take action. We're seeing old ideas that were very bad come back and be given new life. People have been trying to ban TikTok for the last 4 years. You know, banning TikTok has been a thing some people have wanted to do, out of xenophobia, out of anti-China sentiment, out of this sort of rising new Cold War of China that I hope we can avert. And it came back and passed this time. And everyone I talked to on the Hill told me it was about Gaza and censoring the truth about Gaza. And Mitt Romney, during a discussion with Secretary Blinken, said that outright loud. And the reason why I stress this is that a bunch of very, you know, smug know-it-all types have been saying, oh, you people think this is about Gaza. You can fix this with Googling or, you know, learn what's really going on. And, you know, every office I'm talking to is saying this is about Gaza. And now Mitt Romney and Blinken come out and say this is about Gaza. So we are banning people, trying to ban the distribution of a social media app not one that I terribly enjoy. That the TikToks I've seen, I've not been big fans of. But, you know, because we blame that for the fact that young people know the truth about a genocide and do not want to be part of it. And the other thing is, this year was one of the many years where Section 702, the surveillance power that is not supposed to be used against U.S. citizens, supposed to be used only for foreigners abroad. But, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, if we incidentally collect the information of U.S. citizens, which we're not doing on purpose, we swear, we can search it without a warrant. And that was another proposal that was stalling, because you had this unusual, but not in my line of work, but I think to most people thinking, unusual left-right coalition where people on the Libertarian part of the Republican Party, and I hate to even say this, the MAGA part of the Republican Party, and then all of the progressive Democrats who have for, you know, 15 years opposed this, were unwilling to vote on this unless you had got a warrant requirement to search U.S. citizens' data. And they went behind closed doors, the head of the Intelligence Committee, and said, we have to pass this to spy on U.S.-based pro-ceasefire protesters. And I want to, again, clarify that the whole justification for 702 is that it does not apply to American citizens and cannot intentionally apply to American citizens. And then in the last couple weeks, we've seen young people showing more moral courage than any of our leadership in Washington go out and have these encampments. Go out and have, in some cases, not even encampments, just protests on a lawn. And they've been met with brutal police repression, tear gas, rubber bullets, attacks, arrest, not just of the students, but of the professors, yeah, of journalists covering them. And throughout this entire time, you have these members of Congress, dare I call them outside agitators, pushing for more police violence, pushing to escalate things. And the latest example, and there's too many to go through them all, we'll be here all week, is that in D.C., there was a very peaceful, very chill encampment at GWU, George Washington University, staged by Students for Justice in Palestine from 9 local colleges. And I went over there multiple times. It was, and did you ever get a chance? I know Medea was over there. I don't know if you made it over there. It was very low. It was very inspiring, but it was not threatening. People with Israeli flags were walking around. The police shut the street to traffic. It was not a threatening anti-Semitic mob, but they asked the D.C. police to disperse them, and the mayor's office, to their credit, said, no, we won't do this unless there's violence. Or if radical groups join. And I don't know what if radical groups join. That one, as a expert on McCarthyism, made me concerned. And then the House of Representatives Oversight Committee, which has oversight responsibilities over the death of the First Amendment in this country, which has oversight responsibilities on why we're not following the Leahy laws when it comes to Israel, which has oversight responsibilities on why we're not complying with the Convention on Genocide, which we're not. You know, you had a federal judge say it was plausible Israel and the U.S. were violating the Convention on Genocide, but that's a political question for branches like Congress. And the Oversight Committee decided to have an oversight hearing on D.C.'s response to anti-Semitism and lawlessness. That was how they phrased this. And I just have to stress to people, we're not a state in D.C., so we don't have the same rights as you do, as horrible as things are with your members of Congress. We don't even have members of Congress, and the Congress as a whole can override our local will. And the day the hearing was supposed to happen, the NPD, that's the D.C. police, went into the encampment and arrested 30-some people. They maced people, and then they called off the hearing and called it a victory. Because these Republicans got the D.C. police to reverse itself, defy the will of the people of this city, and beat up and brutalize a bunch of college students. I saw a picture last night before I went to bed of a young woman in a wheelchair, you know, being zip-tied. Like, this is what we're so afraid of. Young women in a wheelchair, 19 years old, peacefully saying, I don't want my college to be part of a part of a genocide, and these big, brave police come and take her away and mace her friends, and these big, courageous Republicans cheer it on and root for more violence.
And you are listening to Anne Wright, Rachel and Craig Corey, and Chip Given. And I just want to come back and riff off of what Chip was saying, particularly about the students, and go back to Cindy and Craig, and then chirp in for sure. The Evergreen State College recently agreed to student demands to negotiate about divesting from Israel. And this is where Rachel graduated from. Talk about your thoughts about the issues of the college activities, the colleges moving to divest from Israel. And let's continue this discussion. Cindy and Craig?
We were incredibly heartened by the process that we were able to observe at the Evergreen State College. A week ago, we were invited to come out to the campus for a day-long rally. The students asked members of the community to come out and join them, but they had an encampment for some days. They started very quickly to talk to the administration about their demands. That process continued. The police were not called to the campus by the administration. There were a couple of deadlines set for how long the encampment should stay there and should remain. And then the students negotiated with the administration and actually were able to extend the time of the encampment as they worked through this process. But on that Monday, a week, they signed a memo of understanding with the administration, and there are four task forces that have been set up that will initiate their work this spring and then will continue until they resolve some of the issues that were addressed. One task force deals with Evergreen investment, and this is something we had some experience with. Back in 2003, students were trying to find out how Evergreen was invested when we set up a scholarship, or when the community did, in Rachel's name. Students wanted to know how was that money going to be invested. And it was quite a battle, and never succeeded, because at that time, I'm not sure about the current situation, but Evergreen was invested with the University of Washington, and the University of Washington had an agreement that said Evergreen could be invested with them, but there could be no challenges to how the money was invested. So there's a lot of work ahead, I know, for the students, but definitely they're going to be looking at how funds are invested for the college, and what companies, particularly violations, are on that list. So we're looking forward to the work that they'll be doing. They're also looking at grants that come to the college, because those are used sometimes to really limit, I think, what can happen on campus when grant money comes that way. So that's a second task force. And then another task force on the oversight of the police department, a third very important step. And then looking at alternative models of crisis response. The other thing, in their memo of understanding, the administration agreed at the students' demand and request to have a statement from the administration. And just yesterday, the president of the college, Mr. Carmichael, put out a statement from Evergreen. And he said, I am horrified and grief-stricken by the violence and suffering being inflicted due to the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mourn the destruction of universities and hospitals, the killing of journalists, and want to see the release of prisoners being held without due process. And he's talking about Gaza and Palestine. I wish to see an end to the violence and restoration of international law, including respect for the March 25th, 2024 United Nations resolution that called for a lasting, sustainable ceasefire honored by all parties, the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, expanded humanitarian assistance, and the protection of civilians. Restoration of international law also requires that the International Court of Justice fairly adjudicate charges of genocide. And there's more that people can read. But watching what's happening in other places, we know the college well. We appreciate our relationship there. So it's been heartening to us to see this kind of a process play out there.
When I speak regularly to comrades in the West Bank, who we've been able to connect with, like Jamal Juma, who is one of the major leaders who has been trying to stop the creation of the apartheid wall and is also deeply involved with the Bedouin community in trying to stop the theft of land and the creation of settlements and the destruction of both the people of the West Bank and their livelihood, oftentimes burning and killing their livestock and the like. And he said, tell the students they are the most heartening development we have seen. They are globalizing in the best sense, the Intifada. They're taking it to the world of humanity, and they're making a substantive change. So thank you still, Rachel Corey, and the students throughout the world, and certainly this country, who have stood up for a free, free Palestine. And I know that you wanted to get some words in there, Anne Wright, because you're heading back to the Capitol for protest. And one of the things that you are bringing, we go from our younger people to our older people, you're engaged in an action that's going to bring the marvelous singing group that has now taken on national proportions, Raging Grannies, to the Capitol to protest. So talk about your ongoing activity for a free, free Palestine, and any of your thoughts relative to what Cindy has said. We still have to get Craig to weigh in here as well, and or what Chip has been saying.
Well, before we hit the Raging Grannies, I'll just internationalize the student movement. It's really been amazing to see these encampments that have happened now all over the world, to include Turkey, where I've just come from. But now I'm in Washington, D.C. I've been part of the a lobbying group since November of last year, and I'm back in D.C., and today the Raging Grannies have come in to Washington on behalf of grannies all over the world who say, don't kill any more grandmothers, don't kill any more mothers, don't kill any more children. And we're going to all the grandmothers who are members of the U.S. Congress and having a Raging Granny singing opportunity, a concert tonight at Church of the Brethren here in Washington, D.C. Stand by for the Raging Grannies and no more killing of any child, any mother's child.
You know, but I want to, you had raised something that I wanted to go back to, the discussion of whether it's BlackRock or some similar organization that has been hired as contractors in Rafah and so on. You know, raise that issue for us.
The Israeli government had contracted with an American private security firm to run the control points of in and out of Gaza going into Egypt. What an astounding development, if it's true, that an American private contracting firm will be running an international customs and immigration thing on behalf of an occupying power that has no right to be to control that Rafah gate anyway. So these are things that we need to have raised. Yes. So these are, you know, things that are coming up every single day. And as Chip rightly identified, all of the horrible, horrible things that these evil, mean Congress people. I mean, in the 5 months that we've been batting our heads against the wall in Congress, we have heard some of the most astoundingly evil and vile comments coming out of the mouths of our U.S. congressmen and women. It is just horrifying to see what brutality that they have in their hearts toward other people.
And Craig, we, you know, I want to get your voice into this too. As how do you evaluate or understand this time? But a Palestinian activist attorney with Pal Alta said, Lamise Deeks, things will get far worse before they get better. But how do you understand with the Rachel Corey Foundation and the sacrifice of your family, of your beloved, for a really a free, free Palestine, where we're at this time? Certainly the rise in activity, notwithstanding which we'll continue to look at the repression of the state in response to the enormity of the activism from the youth community and, frankly, organized labor, who's beginning to weigh in.
As you pointed out, Mimi, this is the settler colonial project. Israel is trying to take the land and spit out the people. The farmers, the children, the mothers, the citizens are not collateral damage. They're the targets. It's the collateral damage, it seems to me, is what Chip was talking about. It is international law. It's U.S. law. It's what we're doing to each other. It's what's happening on the campuses. We need to look at each of these individual things and put them together and realize that there's not going to be any peace here as long as Israel is coveting somebody else's land. The Palestinians, to have what Israel would take as a negotiating part, they have to negotiate their own demise. It's not going to happen. So the pressure needs to be put on Israel, and I commend the students. I've had people say, isn't this wonderful when we be a part of a large rally, maybe 3,000 people in Little Olympia? Of course, they came from Seattle. We don't have enough people to do that, but many of them, but a lot of people in Olympia. I think there were 300 in the rain last Saturday marching about this. And to me, it's not wonderful because of why it's necessary. I'm certainly glad that people come out here.
Where were you stationed in 68 during the...
Well, I was drafted, or I volunteered to not be drafted and have Christmas at home in 68. So by 1970, I was just north of Saigon in Cambodia or Vietnam with the 1st Air Cavalry Division. So I spent 11 months and 5 days there, but who's counting? But I guess my point is that in the 60s, a lot of that was impacting students themselves. Now you're looking at students who are working for somebody and realize their ties to somebody that are 10,000 miles away. That's a different deal. And I'm really in awe of these students. And as Cindy said, we learned a lot from them when we had the privilege of being out at Evergreen and listening to what they had to say.
And what do you think is evoking that kind of consciousness? So where does the consciousness, you think, come from after a period of relative quiescence, aside from the boots on the ground over the police murder of George Floyd? Where do you think it comes from that helps people understand the issue of genocide, ethnicized? Also, for many, many young Jews, depart from their parents and say there's nothing liberal about Zionism. Zionism is reactionary nationalism. It is a destructive, genocidal form of colonialism. Where does that come from as you can see it, Craig? And I want folks to weigh in and give us some of their final thoughts and concerns about where we are today from your particular perspective, what's happening with the flotillas, and Chip, come back in and give us a sense of that we also have to be cognizant of and demonstrative in our fight to keep our rights to protest, and that this is hand in glove with the struggle for a free, free Palestine. Craig, your thoughts.
Well, I'll just come back a little bit to my relationship with my daughter, Rachel. I think that often our children reflect our better values back at us. And so as I tell people, Rachel was always in my heart, but by golly, she was often in my face. And so we should be listening to these young people and asking them where they get this. And I think we'll find out that they got it from us, and we are the ones that abandoned our values.
And young people in different parts of the movement dealing with different things definitely found their voices. You know, what we've seen happen with organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, that's been developing. We, Craig and I, have been involved since 2003. And we saw some of the earliest voices. Jewish Voice for Peace had started just a few years before. And we saw some of those early voices, so powerful, come out. And that has just built and built through the years. I also think, you know, that young people, all of us, even with limiting, with preventing media from being able to go into Gaza, having to rely on people whose lives are terribly threatened, all the journalists that have been lost within Gaza is just so incredibly awful. Even with that situation, people have been watching this now for, 7 months, looking for information, finding places. Young people, certainly on social media, not me so much, but the young people seeing what's happening, and they are rightly rejecting that. So I think that's where it's coming from. When I think about what's most on my mind right now, it is the people in Gaza and the threat to their lives, the famine that's occurring, what we're hearing about really no trucks getting in through Kerem Shalom crossing. You know, there are different reports. I'm not sure what's accurate, but it's just so alarming to hear what's happening. And I have conversations with far too many colleagues in Gaza who have lost family members, multiple family members. And to see that continue is so painful. And having walked in Rafah with Anne, having crossed that crossing, just to imagine what the challenges are for people there is devastating. And so that's where my primary concern right now lies. And I feel like we have to do everything that we can to grab this moment when the Biden administration is taking some minimal action and see if we can't have that expand.
And you were given the handed the torch to take up from where Cindy was going. And you have been the ever ready bunny battery for peace and against empire since your resignation in protest of the illegal war in Iraq and the actions of then President Bush. So your thoughts now, the work that you're going to be doing, what we need to know, and then we want to bring Chip in to round it off and again to make sure that we understand that the issue of a free Palestine is also an issue of world humanity, world peace, and you can't have that, as Peter Tosh says, without equal rights and justice, and what happens with our siblings in Palestine inures to our own freedoms for sure. Anne Wright?
Sooner or later, people's conscience does get the better of them. Sometimes it's years and decades later, but there will be a crisis of conscience of all these people that are justifying the genocide, that are complicit in it, that are not doing anything to stop it. And, you know, it's so clear for these young students that they say, you know, I don't really want a job with these law firms that would fire me anyway because of my conscience, that I will tell them when I think they're doing wrong. So, you know, that's a great moral step that a lot of people are taking young in their lives, where a lot of old people haven't done it. And they're regretting it, I think, in a lot of ways. Well, we're in a war right now of conscience, and there's going to be a lot of PTSD from all of this. And there's going to be a lot of people, if there is a hell, there's going to be a lot of people going to hell over this thing. Because for people that are counting this thing, that are saying it's just fine to go ahead and kill 34,000 people in 7 months, and we don't really care, Well, I just hope there is a hell, and they're going to have an annex for all of these people that are doing that. And that's my rant for the day.
But you've got to lift up. No, we're not letting you go there. Also, the work of the veterans, Veterans for Peace, people like yourself who've been trying to raise the issue of the Leahy Law, who are going to Congress today along with the Raging Grannies. But talk about that, too, because they are in the hopper, just like the fact that we have now roughly 270 labor unions that have passed resolutions for a ceasefire. They need to do more. They need to get on board with boycott, sanction, and divestment. But they are there, and in a record time. It took 10 years before we managed to get labor on board to do anything seriously about the Vietnam War and apartheid, and they never really responded to the illegal Iraq War. So let's lift up the veteran community.
That's right. And we do have a group from Veterans for Peace, and we're calling Veterans Against Genocide. That group that came to Washington about a month and a half ago, we lobbied all the members of the Veterans Committee, all the veterans that are in the U.S. Congress. Most of them didn't care that other veterans thought genocide was bad. We've got our little T-shirts there. We also have Teachers Against Genocide, Doctors Against Genocide, all sorts of professional groups that are saying this has got to end. And we've had Aaron Bushnell, who took his own life at the Israeli embassy over genocide that was going on. We had Larry Hubert came all the way from Spain and is in administrative difficulty with the Air Force for taking his own annual leave to come over and lobby in Congress and then having the audacity to go on a hunger strike in front of the White House and put a little sign up there. Active duty veteran says no to genocide, no to killing kids in my name. You know, so we've got and veterans, other veterans that have gone on hunger strikes in front of the White House. So, yes, the veterans community is stepping up saying, not in our name you're going to be doing this stuff. We will keep pushing. And when we get labor involved, we get educators, we get the doctors, the overwhelming number of people that say this has got to end and putting pressure on Biden, which is starting to work. You can see that a little bit. But not nearly enough to have saved those tens of thousands of lives that were brutally taken away by the Israeli horrific, horrific brutality and the U.S. bombs that killed them.
One of the things that when I mention organized labor, I'm with the UAW, United Automobile Workers, and Local 2325, the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys. And we passed a Democratic, after considerable debate and even lawsuit, we passed a resolution for a ceasefire amongst the members. Not long thereafter, we were subpoenaed by the House Committee on Labor and Education, which is chaired by MAGA monster Virginia Fox, in order to kind of dox our union to make sure that internal Democratic information about membership, the construction of the resolution, whatever documents they may want are subpoenaed. And we are now have hired lawyers after considerable debate about fighting back. How severe and how challenged are we going to be as we rise to the occasion, as Craig and Cindy and Ann were talking about fighting back against the crimes of empire, saying no more genocide in our name? What are the issues that we have to be aware of and the fight back for the preservation or the continuation of our rights to dissent, which the empire, the plutocrats, the corporatocracy is trying to narrow considerably?
A majority of Americans support a ceasefire. A majority of members of Congress, a majority of people in the White House support a genocide. And you have a government, you have so-called elected officials who are supporting a genocide when they're supposed to be representing a people who support a ceasefire. And I think there's a real tension caused by this. And as a result, instead of doing what one might do in a democracy and listen to people who voted for you, they are choosing blunt repression of these movements. You mentioned Virginia Fox. She chairs the Education and Workforce Committee. I believe they have a lot of, you know, education and workforce related things to do. They've completely basically just revived HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. They have hearing after hearing where they bring college administrators before them and ask them questions about professors' views, students' views, try to coerce them into taking people's tenure away. They sent a letter to Columbia trying to get Columbia to call in the police and break up the encampment. I mean, the House Education Committee and the Workforce Committee is basically the new HUAC, which is, I mean, it's grotesque from a First Amendment standpoint. There's also a lot of things with access to higher education, with exclusion of the workforce, they could actually be working on, which are in their mandate. And instead, they're trying to get college students beat up for having the wrong view on opposing a genocide. And again, I think we have to be really worried about the demonization. I think we have to be worried about the way that politicians and the media are spinning narratives about these protesters that are false. One might even call it disinformation designed to facilitate state crackdowns. I think we have to be really worried, not just about what's happening immediately at the surface, but what's happening behind closed doors, because we know there is a tremendous history of surveillance of Palestinian activism in this country. Just a year or two after the Church Committee put the most stringent restrictions on the FBI in history, the FBI was spying on Palestinian activists, and they've been spying on them ever since. And we really just have to look at the ways in which the systematic attempts to repress and silence those speaking out against genocide, those speaking out against apartheid, those speaking out for a ceasefire, those speaking out for the Palestinians' human rights are going to face.
And I want you to just raise up for us the Freedom Flotilla, which has got to sail, will sail.
Our demands for 14 years have been for Israel to stop the illegal naval blockade of Gaza, and of course now the demands of stopping a genocide, let the food in for starving people. FreedomFlotilla.org is our website. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're so gracious. You're so wonderful. And ceasefire now, no more genocide in our name. Thank you, Cindy and Craig Corey, in the name of Rachel Corey, who will always be there with us as an inspiration, and Wright, who's going to sing her heart out with the Raging Grannies and tell it to that damn Congress, no more genocide in our name, and Chip Gibbons, who tries to make sure that people like Ann Wright aren't immediately busted and beaten up with the Raging Grannies when they raise their voices to say no more genocide in our name. It's been a pleasure. Thank you all. Keep the pressure on. Keep the pressure on. No more genocide in our name. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. This is Equal Rights and Justice.
You are listening to a 24-hour special on Anakba Day, produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine, with the English stream produced by WPFW. Radio Free Palestine continues after this break. Stay tuned.
FM, WBAI, New York.
I'm grateful to have WBAI. You know, it's not easy in this country. It's very rare, actually, in this country to find platforms, specifically media platforms, where we can say what we want and how we want it. This is a necessary platform. And if we want to continue to archive the voices of Palestinian Americans and pro-Palestinian voices, we got to pay for it, because freedom is not free in America. They told you it was, but it's not. And so being able to be part of the movement to put our money where our mouth is, if we want freedom of speech, we got to invest in that, unfortunately. And fortunately, you get to do that at WBAI with a team of incredible people, some people who've been at WBAI for decades, continuing to maintain this platform so that new generations like mine can access this space. So go to WBAI.org. Give what you can, my friends. What you have is all we need. So we're not asking for millions here. We are asking for grassroots support, $10, $20, $5, $500 if you have it. If you have $1,000, we'll take that too.
Let's keep it going. WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York. Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute. Do what you can. Or call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Do your part to help keep us on the air.
Hey, this is Michael, a BAI buddy from Brooklyn. WBAI, oh, WBAI, you're listening to WBAI, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Listen and learn. And become a BAI buddy today.
8 p.m.